We'll hear argument now on number 87-1437, Melvin Blanton versus the City of North Las Vegas. Mr. Graves, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Blanton and Fraley were arrested and charged with driving under the influence in the City of North Las Vegas, Nevada, in July and June, respectively, of 1986. Blanton made a written demand for jury trial in the municipal court, and that demand was denied. We took a petition for a writ of mandamus to the district court, our court of general jurisdiction, and that request was denied, and we took an appeal to the Nevada Supreme Court. Mr. Fraley, in the North Las Vegas municipal court, made a written demand for a jury trial that was denied. He entered a plea of guilty to the charge. He took an appeal, a trial de novo, to the district court, and the demand for jury trial was granted. From that granting of the demand for jury trial, the City of North Las Vegas took an original writ of certiorari to the Nevada Supreme Court.
The Nevada Supreme Court made no point about Fraley having pleaded guilty.
No, sir, they did not. The Nevada Supreme Court construed the Baldwin case rather strictly, wouldn't we think, and stated that the Baldwin standard of 6 months and $500 was the only standard that it would stand on, and as a result of that, the request for a jury trial in driving under the influence cases was denied. In its decision, it also indicated certain policy reasons. Part of this was expense of the jury trials, juror inconvenience in rural areas, non-lawyer judge problems, and it finally concluded by suggesting that it was up to the legislature to resolve this problem.
Well, it didn't stand that strictly on it, because wasn't the possible fine here more than $500?
Yes, sir. It was $1,000.
So it wasn't really all that wooden.
Sir?
It wasn't all that wooden.
Well, no, sir. The $1,000 fine has been the law in the state of Nevada for several years now. But I think that in most of the lower court cases, I believe that the fine of $500 has been abandoned by most of the courts. I think even in this court, I think in Munoz versus Hoffman, you indicate that it's not talismanic. So
selectively wooden.
It was partially wooden, yes, Your Honor. All right. As this court knows, this country is at war with drunk drivers. In the state of Nevada, that offensive has taken this shape. Upon conviction of a first offense, there is a mandatory fine of $200 and a maximum of $1,000. There's a mandatory incarceration of 2 days or 48 hours of community service while dressed in distinctive garb, identifying the person as a DUI violator. And with the permission of the Chief Justice and the Court, I would ask to be able to show you this distinctive garb here today. It has been described in our brief at pages 14 and 15.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is the front of it. It looks much like a prisoner's uniform. Property of North Las Vegas Court. We received the permission of the city, by the way, to leave this with the court. Property of North Las Vegas Court. On the back is a rather large circle. DUI offender with a skull and crossbones and a bottle of liquor with, looks like a hash mark saying you can't drink. Not exactly a designer, but...
How long do you wear it?
For 48 hours, sir. It's not as if it were just 2 days, but it's...
You could stay at home, couldn't you?
No, sir. You'd want to stay at home with this.
Well, I know, but where do you wear it?
You wear it in the community where you're working the 48 hours of community service. It's
eight-hour
days. It's actually 48 hours. It's not like 2 8-hour days. So while you're working, typing, or whether you're sweeping the road, or whether you're sweeping a hall in a public building.
Mr. Graves, if you get a jail sentence, do you also have to do this?
No, sir.
But your position is this even worse than 6 months in jail?
Most of my clients want to do the jail time. They don't want to be caught.
They'd rather go to jail for 6 months than wear this for 48 hours.
Not for 6 months, but for the 2 days. First offenders normally don't go to jail for 6 months. They'll normally just the minimum.
But minimum fine. How is this a more severe penalty than 6 months in jail?
I'm not sure that this is a more severe penalty than 6 months in jail. I think that
if they got 6 months in jail, that would be the maximum under the statute, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir.
Then why isn't this case squarely controlled by Baldwin?
Well, it's our position that I'm not sure that we can make that analogy exactly, Your Honor, because most of the time, and most of the offenses that I have anything to do with, it's 2 days in jail or the 48 hours wearing this particular uniform. But that, I don't know that we can announce that.
That's the choice of the defendant, isn't it?
Yes, sir. It is the choice of the defendant. Generally, the courts would prefer, most courts, it's a mixed bag. Some of the courts have said that they are going to make the choice and the defendant will do the community service because they would rather have the defendant out in the community working as opposed to sitting in jail. And that's the decision that most of the courts make, although sometimes the defendant can make a choice of going to jail for 2 days.
But supposing the statute made the maximum penalty 2 days in jail or alternatively wearing this for 2 days, would that violate, would you then be entitled to a jury trial?
That would be a little bit closer case. I think that this is a badge of dishonor.
Well, I understand that, but what's your answer to my question? You think you would be entitled to a jury trial? Say that was the only penalty. You have to wear this thing for 2 days.
If this was the only penalty and you had to wear that for 2 days, I don't think so.
Well, isn't that what the only penalty is for most people?
No, sir. You've got a mandatory minimum fine of $200 up to $1,000.
Well, say there was this, wear this for 2 days plus a $1,000 fine. That's the maximum penalty. Would that entitle you to a jury?
That would be a closer case. That might entitle us to a jury trial. Because it's just something that most of my clients don't want to be seen in. And it's a badge of dishonor.
Well, I sympathize with that, but you're telling me something new now. I thought that under these statutes, you couldn't force anybody, a judge could not force anybody to wear that. That it has to be at the defendant's option.
Not always, sir. The courts are split on that. Sometimes a judge will require the defendant to do community service.
Well, what does the statute say, doesn't it?
It just says an option, Your Honor. I don't think it specifically says who has the power to require.
It says it's an option. It doesn't say who has the option.
I don't believe so. The courts have construed it in different ways.
When you say the courts, you mean the various courts in Nevada, the
district courts?
Yes, sir.
I say the lower courts that are dealing with this problem on a daily basis. There is normally a choice. I have had clients, I don't want to try to mystify you on this, but I have had clients that have wanted to serve the 2 days in jail as opposed to wearing the uniform, and the courts have allowed them to do that. It's not a hard and fast rule, but they must do one of the other.
The statute, how does it read? This point's important to me. I think we have a different case if somebody can be forced to wear this thing for however long. At least I think it's different. Well, if it's going to take a lot of time, you can do it on rebuttal if you like. I didn't mean to. What do you have it right in hand?
Thank you, Honor. If we can do that, please. I just can't lay my hand on it right away. In any event, with a mandatory fine, the mandatory incarceration, or dress 48 hours in this distinctive garb, there is as well a mandatory education course on alcohol abuse. There's also a mandatory license revocation for 90 days, the second 45 days of which a driver may request a hardship or restricted license. Of course, additionally, this particular crime is hedged around with the additional conditions of being non-negotiable by the prosecutor. And, of course, the court has no jurisdiction to reduce the jail time or the incarceration.
You, of course, don't recognize the rule that any charge that is less than 6 months does not need a jury trial. You just don't recognize that rule.
No, sir. We recognize that rule, and we in our briefs have indicated to the court that we don't think you need to abandon that rule because it served well for 20 years.
Explain to me again why this is different.
Because what the state of Nevada is doing is that they're packing underneath the line. Your rules have said, and the state of Nevada has said, it's 6 months. You puncture that particular incarceration, and then you go into a serious crime. The state of Nevada is staying underneath the line, but it's increasing the punishment. So that all they have to say is, well, ladies and gentlemen of the Supreme Court, we don't have more than 6 months. All we have is 6 months. What we're saying is that they're packing under the line and making other kinds of penalties that, well, ultimately, especially in this kind of case, that will require a jury trial. We don't ask you to
abandon
your 6 months.
Well, would 6 months and 2 days of house arrest be bad?
I'm sorry, sir, I did not understand you.
6 months and 2 days of house arrest.
Would that require a jury trial?
Yeah.
That probably would require a jury trial.
What's the difference between that and this one? Because he can stay at home, but that he doesn't have to wait.
Well, he can't. In the state of Nevada, he can't go home. He must go to a jail for 2 days. Besides, there are additional penalties here.
Did you say he could wear that for 2 days?
Yes, sir, but he has to do community service.
So he doesn't, he has to be out in the street.
Yes, sir. You can't be at home doing this.
That's enough for a jury trial.
Yes, sir. I think so.
That is the only difference.
Not the only difference, no, sir. There are other penalties here. One of the other penalties is a mandatory, sir.
Let me have the other penalty.
The additional penalties are loss of your license for 90 days, 45 days of which are non-suspendable, and you cannot drive for 45 days. The other 45 days, at the tender mercies of the Department of Motor Vehicles in Nevada, you can have a restricted license.
May I ask on that suspension, if you go to jail for 6 months, can you have the 90-day suspension concurrent with the time in jail?
There is no provision for that I'm aware of.
You mean
the penal and the administrative are different. No, sir.
But say you're convicted on January 1st, and the judge enters an order, sends you to jail for 6 months. When will your license be suspended?
It'll be probably suspended even before you go to trial, or even before you enter a plea of guilty. They're very, very rapid.
Suspension.
There.
What I'm trying to find, the suspension would have been completed before you finished your 6 months in jail.
Yes, sir. Under one way or the other, yes, sir. It would. Upon his second conviction of driving under the influence in the state of Nevada within 7 years, it's a 10-day mandatory jail time, a $500 mandatory minimum fine, and a 1 year loss of license. And there's no restricted license there. The third conviction within 7 years is 1 year to 6 years in the Nevada State Prison. It's a felony. It carries a mandatory minimum $2,000 fine and 3 years loss of license.
But we're speaking only of the first conviction in this case.
Yes, sir, we are. But what we're suggesting is that the second and third convictions are conditions and provisions that this court can take into consideration to gauge the seriousness of this crime in the minds of the people of the state of Nevada through their legislators.
Well, it is pretty serious, of course. Incidentally, your statute is in the petition for cert, if you need it.
Thank you. Just a moment. This court has historically used two types of tests for gauging the seriousness of a crime. One of those is nature of the offense, and the other is the penalty of the offense. And then there is sort of a subtest, which is the actual numbers of states, which...
Mr. Graves, didn't the Baldwin case really move to a more bright-line test?
Yes, ma'am, it did.
And why should we get away from that?
You don't have to get away from the bright-line test, except that this case doesn't have a bright-line penalty. You have gotten away from bright-line tests in the past, in your Franks case, in the Frank case.
Well, this meets Baldwin, in a sense.
It does. It meets Baldwin. And if the court sends the message to the states that you can have other penalties besides the 6 and 5, which is what we used to call it when I was in municipal court, 6 months in jail and a $500 fine, then we're going to have all sorts of things that are going to be happening underneath the line. Because as long as the state doesn't puncture the line and move into the serious area, then we can have all sorts of penalties underneath.
Well, don't you think we have to adjust the $500 for inflation? What's the inflation rate since we picked 500? I mean, I know the Constitution says how many dollars for a civil jury, but I really don't think our court opinions are as written in stone as the Constitution is.
I don't think so.
So 500, maybe 1,000 is the equivalent nowadays of 500 before, no?
I do not stand on the fact that the $500 is written in stone. It could be $1,000. It could be even $2,000. I just, again, I agree with the court. I don't think it's talismanic. And
Baldwin didn't say anything about a fine, did it?
No, sir. I think it was pretty much the incarceration.
6 months.
And I think he pretty much stood on that. But the nature of the offense, the bright line test lived in Baldwin and in the Duncan cases. But you've got a residuum test that lives beyond that, which is the nature of the offense test. And the lower courts have found, there are some that have not, have found that this is in fact a serious crime, that the nature of the offense is serious. In Baldwin, for example, in footnote 6, any incarceration in excess of 6 months carried the right to jury trial. And in that footnote, per Justice White, there was no overruling of Clowens or Colts. In Duncan, which preceded it by 2 years, sentences up to 6 months if the offense otherwise qualifies as a petty offense. And even as late as 1976, in Ludwig versus Massachusetts, it's a petty offense usually defined by reference to the maximum punishment. And as far as the nature of the offense, of course, although it's sui generis, this court still uses the nature of the offense in contempt cases. So it's certainly a test that is viable and is usable. And we have cited cases that the lower courts have found driving under the influence to be a malum in se crime. It was not apparently indictable at common law, although there was one case, United States versus Hart.
I assume you'd be satisfied if the penalty was a minimum of 25 years and you were given a jury trial.
I would not be satisfied with that, sir. I wouldn't want this to get out of hand.
Well, I was just wondering the way you were going in your argument.
Well, sir, I can't make a general statement. I just know that under the statute that we have here, sir, that we feel that this particular crime is serious, not only because of the nature of the offense, but also because of the penalty. And because 44 jurors... Sir?
If it's serious, then the penalty should be more.
Yes, sir.
And that's your argument? Well,
no,
we
sir.
I'm not raising the penalty.
I'm not suggesting, sir, that the penalty ought to be more and then grant us the right to jury trial. I'm suggesting that the crime per se carries the right to a jury trial because it is malum in se and has been so held by the lower courts. What I'm suggesting to the court is that 20 to 22 states, in fact, do punish first offense driving under the influence by 1 year. New York, Alabama, there are places that punish driving under the influence first offense by 1 year, and they give you a right to jury trial. And if a court reviews its cases in this regard, and you take Callan, for example, 1888, it is an offense of a grave nature affecting the public at large. That's DUI. Schick, 1904, it is a crime of moral delinquency. That's DUI. Colts, 1930, it is a grave offense. That is DUI. And then when you take a look at the mala prohibita crimes, the Colts in 1930, for the court to characterize reckless driving, or in this case, DUI, as a petty crime would be to shock the general moral sense. And this court may write a decision that says that driving under the...
In fact, this is a malum prohibitum, isn't it? What's the alcohol level here? Is it the case that everyone who has this amount of alcohol in his blood is necessarily impaired? I thought the level was set at such a point where someone could be. And so even if you have a greater immunity to the effect of alcohol than some other people, if you get picked up, it's your tough luck. And I would consider that a malum prohibitum. I mean, to be falling down drunk when you're driving is malum in se. But to have your alcohol level above a certain point where someone else might be affected but you aren't, do you consider that malum in se?
Well, yes, sir. I'm not sure that you can make the distinction between an alcohol level and whether somebody else is going to react differently to alcohol than anybody else. In the state of Nevada,
you're saying it's malum in se to have point whatever the thing in your blood is?
What I'm saying is that is the considered judgment of the legislature of the state of Nevada, that there are two ways to convict in the state of Nevada for driving under the influence. One is .10 or greater, and that's per se. It's presumptive that you're driving under the influence. The second one are the factual, that if you refuse a test, for example, then if you're weaving down the road and if your breath is reeking of alcohol and there are other physical attributes, then I think that in any event, that it's malum in se.
Is it the same penalty?
You're saying if the legislature makes it unlawful, it's malum in se.
No, sir. No, sir.
Well, then you have to convince me that having .10 in your blood necessarily means that no reasonable person, no honorable person would consider driving with .10. I don't know that that's true. I think that's a number picked with a good deal of safety margin to embrace some people who may indeed not be affected at that level.
Well, as a practical matter, they are tried together. The .10 and also the physical characteristics, of course, are all tried together. But in any event, the .10 and the driving under the influence both carry the same penalties. So no matter how you prove the case, you're still subjected to the same sentence and the same conviction of driving under the influence. And I don't think that the .10, or whether it was a .15, would make that much difference in the analogy. I'm missing the question, but I don't.
I'm trying to figure out, I guess, how heinous this crime is viewed by the citizenry. And if to be convicted means you were falling down drunk when you were driving, yes, I'd say that's a pretty heinous thing. But suppose the state passes a law that says we don't want people on the roads who have had anything to drink, and they set the level, you know, real minimum. You shouldn't drink any alcohol within 3 hours before you drive. Now, would you consider that malum in se to violate that law?
I'm not, just for the fact of driving 3 hours before, or drinking 3 hours
before.
That's right.
The state says we're taking no chances. Nobody should have any alcohol in the blood. No drinks within 3 hours of driving.
So any amount of alcohol in the blood then is going to be a malum in se.
Would that be malum in se?
I don't think that would be malum in se.
Well, then you've got to tell me why .10 is, you have to convince me that .10 really means that the average, at least the average person, is
seriously
impaired.
Are we talking about driving
impaired
and drinking at this time? The 3 hours before? All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that the state of Nevada has picked .10. 39 states have picked that level as presumptively under the influence. And that's the standard that we have to work with. I'm sorry that I can't answer your question any more specifically, but if we're moving back from the area of driving under the influence to drinking 3 hours before you get onto the road, and that is going to be a crime, just drinking 3 hours, that is a petty crime. That's malum prohibitum. But once you get behind the wheel, then you trigger this offense. There is no driving impaired in the state of Nevada. It's just driving under the influence.
Call it driving under the influence. Would be any alcohol in your blood.
That probably would be a malum prohibitum crime because it is just too low. After 3 hours, it would be in any event. The penalty provision of this crime, it's not just the fine and incarceration as in Baldwin. As the court has seen, the state of Nevada has moved away from just the fine and imprisonment and has moved on to other areas. Basically, what the state wants is to have their cake and to eat it too. One of the penalties that I think is the most important of this particular crime is losing your license, because you're losing the right to use the public highways. And the state of Nevada, and we're only talking about the state of Nevada.
Is your license revoked in the criminal proceeding, or is it a separate administrative proceeding?
It is a separate administrative proceeding.
And well, that really isn't a criminal penalty, then, in many senses of the word.
Yes, sir, it is, because as soon as you are convicted of driving under the influence, then the court sends notice to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and they will automatically revoke your license.
Well, I thought you said a moment ago that your license could have been revoked before trial.
Yes, sir, it can. There are two provisions in the state of Nevada. One of the provisions administratively is that as soon as you are arrested, if you have .10 or greater blood in your of alcohol in your blood, then your license is revoked because of that. Then later on,
that doesn't make it a criminal proceeding.
No, sir.
That so far.
No, sir. And then we move on to when there is a conviction. And then when you are convicted, they revoke your license on the basis of the conviction. Now, they do give you credit for the time that you've served over here. So if your blood was .10 or greater and you got a 90-day suspension, you're convicted, and then over here, you have a revocation because of the conviction, you're given the credit for the 90 days you have here over here. But there's still a penalty involved because you've got the actual revocation is on your record at the Department of Motor Vehicles. So they've got two chances to revoke your license, but we don't particularly speak about the first one since that really doesn't have anything to do with the criminal case unless you're actually convicted. In summation, I would advise the court that we think that you should apply all three tests and not to abandon the Baldwin standard. Now, it may be presumptively petty if the Baldwin standard is not breached, but we feel that in this particular case that all three should be utilized by the court for this particular offense. My own opinion is that driving under the influence is really sui generis. There is no other crime of which I am aware that is really vying for serious status. None. And I've been in this area for probably 6 or 7 years. And although, of course, defense attorneys always try to get jury trials, as a practical matter, they don't get them. This case, the lower courts, this type of offense, the lower courts are riddled with instances where the courts have given jury trials in these types of cases. And, of course, this court has said that there is a deep commitment to jury trials. I mean, when you consider the types of offenses that this court has denied jury trials in, the Clowens case, selling the unused portions of railway excursion tickets, and the Schick case, failure to stamp the oleomargarine, Natal, a private market 6 squares from a public market. Those are trifling offenses. This is not a trifling offense. The cost of this...
When you say the courts are riddled with these cases, you're speaking Nevada courts?
No, sir. I'm talking about no...
Well, let's talk about Nevada, shall we?
All right. The state of Nevada, there is no right to trial by jury in a driving under the influence case. Now, in the lower courts, state and federal, many courts have allowed the right to jury trial in DUI cases. That's what I'm saying. If this court were to rule for us, for the petitioners, and allow a jury trial in the state of Nevada, this is probably what's going to happen. The state legislature is going to move this offense into the district court. Just like Ludwig versus Massachusetts, you're going to move it right, it's going to be moved right up there. There's a great waiver factor. I mean, we've shown that in our opening brief, that there's a great waiver factor, not only in misdemeanor cases generally, but in DUI cases in particular, and that is also true in the Baldwin case. I mean, even in the state of Nevada, they're giving DUI jury trials in Washoe County, but we don't have them in Clark and the rest of the surrounding areas. So even in the state of Nevada itself, we're granting jury trials. And lastly, I think that since the court has ruled on punishment other than incarceration.
Washoe County granting jury trials after the opinion of the Supreme Court of Nevada in this case?
Yes, sir. It's my understanding from the ACLU's amicus curiae brief that in fact, they are, I'd have to defer, but I think they're still granting jury trials. They just feel that it's coming, and they're going ahead and preparing of it for it. I think in 1987 they only had 12 at a cost of $4,000.
We can't take judicial notice of facts in an amicus brief, can we?
No, sir.
Well, what are you telling us that for?
Well, I'm just indicating to the court that I feel that that may be true. I cannot persuade the court otherwise, but that's just what I'm led to believe. But in any event, I would sincerely urge the court to grant us jury trials in driving under the influence cases in the state of Nevada. And I would reserve the rest of my time if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Mr. Zaloris, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At the outset, I wish to point out that the issue raised earlier with regard to the DUI punishment provisions in Nevada is set out, the punishment statute in full is set out in the Nevada Attorney General amicus brief, Appendix A, pages 1A and 2A. And essentially what that provides is, it is the court's discretion whether to allow the defendant, the convicted defendant, to perform 48 hours of community service wearing the distinctive garb, or whether to serve the minimum two-day jail sentence. That is literally what the statute provides.
Why do you think they have that, wear that distinctive garb with that thing on the back of it? Isn't that a great indication that this is a shameful thing? It wouldn't mean anything to have somebody wear that kind of a thing and says, I sold the unused portion of a railway ticket. That wouldn't get anybody to think less of you particularly, would it?
No, clearly it serves a couple of functions, one of which is
it's shameful, isn't it?
To the others, I would submit it would be to the person.
It's shameful. Yes. Now, what if a state decides we're not getting enough convictions in child molestation cases because the young witnesses get intimidated by the courtroom and the jury and all of that, and we think that the real punishment in a child molestation case is just being convicted because that'll ruin you. So we're going to reduce the sentence from 5 years to 6 months. And we're going to provide for trial of all child molestation cases without a jury. We're sure we'll get a lot more convictions, and that'll be worth it. What do you think? Could a state do that?
Is Your Honor's question, would that offense still be a serious offense in the constitutional context?
Yes.
Not under the rulings from this court. No, it would not.
Do you think that's what we'd hope we'd hold?
I believe that's what the court would hold under the
You would like that result, that people could be convicted of child molestation without a jury trial? And you think that's what the framers really thought they were doing?
Not particularly, but I seriously doubt, although I accept your hypothetical, that a state would make such a serious offense. If I may, by way of analogy to the state statutory scheme in Nevada, we have a misdemeanor annoying a minor offense, and that characteristically is prosecuted where there was no physical harm or no physical touching of the child other than perhaps exterior. We then have more opprobrious offenses providing a higher punishment than the six-month misdemeanor line. So by way of example to the Nevada statutes, I believe what Your Honor is referring to is child molestations where there's some physical violation of
the You would acknowledge that if I don't think that I would hold that way in the case of a child molestation statute that's reduced from 5 years to 6 months, then my concern in this case would be more than just the 6 months. It would also be whether this is a shameful crime or not, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't see that that is analogous to this situation when you make it with reference to the distinctive garb. I would respectfully submit
just arguing about how shameful it is.
Well, clearly it's shameful, but there are many misdemeanors for which a penalty such as provided in Nevada in the DUI law are also shameful. I would submit that domestic battery, for example, is shameful conduct. So is, in Nevada, we have a scheme by which possession of drugs can be given misdemeanor treatment. That's shameful. Petty larceny, a crime of moral turpitude, is shameful. Certainly there's more moral turpitude in the mens rea involving a petty larceny offense than there is in a DUI offense. The respondent submits that the decision below was compelled by the holding and logic of this court's decisions in Duncan, Frank, and Baldwin. There are three major points to this presentation. First, the bright line test of Baldwin established 6 months incarceration as the threshold between petty and serious offenses. This rule is easily identified and readily applied. It lends itself to uniform application throughout.
May I interrupt for just a moment, because is the constitutional question, I guess, is whether this is a criminal prosecution within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment.
That's correct.
That's where what we're boiled down. The 6 months, it was a decision in the Baldwin case. And your position is this is not a criminal prosecution.
Oh, no, Your Honor. It's clearly a criminal prosecution under Nevada law, but it does not break the threshold established in the Baldwin case, which necessitates, under the command of the Constitution, as this Court has interpreted it, for a jury trial.
Now, it would be a criminal prosecution within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment if the right to counsel were at stake, wouldn't it?
The Sixth Amendment right to counsel that Your Honor alludes to clearly applies
to this case.
Yes, it does.
Because it's a criminal prosecution. Because that's exactly the Sixth Amendment begins in all criminal prosecutions, these different rights.
That's true, but more specifically because there's jail time that, in fact, has to be imposed.
But what you're really saying is that there are some criminal prosecutions that some prosecutions are criminal within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment for one purpose but not for another. the same words have different meanings depending on what the right you're asserting.
The level of the criminal offense, as defined by the severity of the maximum authorized penalty, determines the jury trial question, not whether it is or is not a criminal prosecution.
Well, but that's not, of course, what the text of the Sixth Amendment says.
That's true.
Perhaps you could refer Justice Stevens to the reasoning of the court in the Argersinger case to explain why the word criminal prosecution, at least in the eyes of the court, could be read differently for one purpose than for the other.
There is a parallel, and this is a point I wish to make in my argument, between the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and the Sixth Amendment jury trial right. That parallel, the key factor, is incarceration. There is a distinction between the two as they have been accepted in our interpretation of those provisions. First, the right to counsel, it has been held that that is a key element, whether the offense is a minor one, such as a misdemeanor in Nevada would be, or whether it's a more serious offense where a jury trial would come into play, that the accused is entitled to at least understand the nature of the proceedings and have the assistance of counsel. It's more important in the incarceration area, where jail time is in the offing, than it is when we get to the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. There is great historical precedent that even predates our country for having non-jury adjudications in what are classified as petty offenses. This is the teachings of this court's case precedent. The second point to which I refer this court is that there is no constitutional mandate to provide jury trials for persons accused of drunk driving. To create such a right would extend the present limit of the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial, as applied to the states via the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, beyond the scope of that imposed upon the federal courts.
May I ask one other question along Justice Scalia's line? Supposing the judge had the authority under this statute to not to put anybody in jail for 6 months, but to just say make them wear this jacket for 6 months. Do you think they'd be entitled to a jury trial?
No, clearly not. And that, I submit, is an appropriate, although whether one personally agrees with it or not, I think it's an appropriate sanction that the state may impose.
What if they asked him to wear it for 7 months?
No, because incarceration, that is the deprivation of liberty, is the essential point to the Sixth Amendment jury trial right. And that does not provide deprivation of liberty, for the same reason that fine amount is not a significant factor in the determination of the jury trial right.
Six months and $1 million fine, which would pretty much pauperize whoever is hit with that. That would not entitle you to a jury trial.
Would that even be the case? No court demands $1 million payment or $100 payment on the spot at the moment of conviction. I would submit that $1 million is excessive. Whether it calls into the jury trial issue or not is another question, and I respectfully submit that's not before the court at this time. However, to answer Your Honor's question, even that exorbitant fine is ameliorated by the ability of the defendant to pay it in installments or to work it off in community service. However, in Nevada, and this is why the $1 million fine, if worked off in terms of community service, would not match the $1 million amount. It's because the community service is limited to 120 hours in a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the particulars of Nevada. I'm talking about the principle you're asking us to adopt. I mean, we've said six months is a general matter, but you're saying that 6 months in prison is the only test, no matter what else you do to somebody. A fine of enormous amounts, making them wear jackets or anything else. Nothing counts except 6 months in jail.
That is the primary or the most relevant.
Why?
Criteria.
Because we've said that.
No, because if the court is focused on deprivation of liberty, the restraint on liberty is the key that triggers the Sixth Amendment jury trial right, just as it triggers the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment. That
about
is the
key. Liberty to wear what kind of a shirt you want.
Well, I submit that is. It pales in significance to incarceration of the person where they're forced to wear the jail garb and their liberty is confined to the cell in which they reside at the time of their incarceration. The petitioner's collateral consequences approach, and this is my third major point I wish to make, and reliance on the nature of the offense test are untenable. These concepts lack definable boundaries. They fail to provide courts with a clear-cut guideline to follow. And this is because of their vulnerability to subjective interpretation. The bright line test established 6 months as the maximum term of incarceration beyond which the jury trial right is triggered. Below that, the court has held, the jury trial right is not invoked by the constitutional provisions. In Duncan, this case extended that jury trial right to the states through the incorporation doctrine of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. However, there is a limitation on that extension. It applies to the states only to the extent that that jury trial right is imposed in federal courts. Should this court rule in petitioner's favor, in fact, there will be extended a greater constitutional right, broader in scope, than that that is imposed upon the federal courts. This is in direct violation to the Duncan ruling. It also...
Why do you say it will be greater than that imposed for the federal courts?
Because the petitioners have relied upon not the six-month incarceration rule, but these collateral consequences of the conviction. In the federal courts, this court has determined that in a federal case, Frank versus the United States, that a 3-year probationary term, which has more onerous restraints on the defendant than does the statutory scheme of DUI in Nevada, resulted in the court finding in Frank that it was not a serious offense in the constitutional context of that term.
So what you're saying, in effect, is that if we rule for the petitioner here, we will, in effect, overrule a Frank case?
That's correct, and the Duncan ruling. The application of Duncan, that Duncan made of the Sixth Amendment to the states, is limited to the extent to which it is applied in federal courts. I submit that would be the only alternative. You'd have to overrule, you'd have to extend it beyond that provided to the states. And I think Frank illustrates the point. Frank was a federal criminal contempt matter. And the court in sentencing, rather suspended sentence on Ben Frank, and instead imposed a 3-year term of probation with, and I wish to note, the specific probationary conditions imposed on Mr. Frank. First, he was not allowed to travel outside the state without permission of the probation officer. He was required to work regularly, secondly. Thirdly, he was required to report any changes in his work schedule with his probation officer. He was told he could only associate with law-abiding persons. And he was to maintain reasonable work hours. I submit that those conditions placed on the probationer in the Frank case are much more forceful restraint on liberty than are the collateral consequences to which the petitioners rely. I believe this puts petitioners in essence in a checkmate position on their argument, out of which they cannot come without overturning the basic ruling of Duncan. Again, the critical distinction in the Sixth Amendment jury trial and Sixth Amendment right to counsel cases is the deprivation of liberty, the punishment. Specifically, with regard to some of the collateral consequences to which the petitioners allude, I think a short analysis is appropriate, especially in comparison with the probationary provisions in the Frank case. The mandatory jail provision is ameliorated by the fact that the defendant could perform the 48 hours of community service. It's further ameliorated by the fact that, characteristically, courts credit the individual with the time he served in jail at his arrest and do not require an additional 2 days if, in fact, he served 2 days before he came before the magistrate for his initial appearance. Secondly, petitioners have referred to the enhancement aspect of the DUI statute. That is that for second and third offenses, the penalty rises, and on the third offense, it would become a felony. That is not an unusual statutory scheme because of the Habitual Criminal Act that we have in Nevada and that many states provide. For example, after the third petty larceny, it becomes a felony upon prosecution and conviction of the fourth petty larceny if the district attorney determines to file it as a felony. And that calls for a mandatory minimum 10 years in prison with a maximum of 20 years. Moreover, in the petty larceny realm still, after the fifth petty larceny conviction, that is, upon the sixth petty larceny, the statute provides for life imprisonment in Nevada. Cannot the same argument be made, unlike what I think counsel for petitioners has suggested, that someone may come before this court, if they're able to reach this level, and argue in a petty larceny case that, well, I'm subject to enhanced penalties, and if I commit five more petty larcenies, I'll go to prison for life. Therefore, it's serious in the constitutional context. I believe this is analogous to their argument regarding enhancement. It also holds true for the domestic battery situation with regard to enhancement and also with regard to the claim that the social opprobrium that accompanies a conviction for DUI is somehow significant enough to elevate what is otherwise a petty offense into the serious category. For example, in domestic battery in Nevada, the officer must make an arrest if there was a battery committed between persons who are related by blood or marriage, and there is some other evidence, such as physical evidence, to indicate that that crime has occurred. That person cannot make bail for 12 hours. It's a non-bailable offense, which at this point, of course, is merely an accusatory stage. In addition, there are other collateral consequences. Once a battery conviction results, the court has the ability to require the person to attend a counseling program. And if the victim is 65 years of age or older, the Nevada statutes provide for, in effect, a doubling of the punishment, in which case it would arise into a serious offense and a jury trial right would have to be provided. But what these illustrate, these examples I've explained, is the fallacy in taking the petitioner's approach of viewing the nature of the offense. The clear-cut guideline established by the objective approach that Baldwin indicates by looking to the maximum authorized penalty is, to paraphrase the Frank decision, the only objective criterion by which a line could ever be drawn on the basis of the possible penalty alone is how we separate petty from serious offenses.
May I ask you one other question about the way the statute works? The statute provides, I gather, the judge can sentence him to 2 days in jail, not less than two or more, or to perform 48 hours of work for the community while dressed in distinctive garb. Could the judge pick the distinctive garb that the judge thought appropriate, or is there a statutory description of it?
There's no statutory description for it. What is in the statute is all we have in terms of
so
guidance.
If the judge thought that this wasn't distinctive enough, the judge could maybe add a dunce cap and a few other foolish-looking things to the...
As I say, the statute doesn't speak to it, so in theory, yes, it could. I would hope that some decorum would be engaged by any court in such an endeavor, however.
But supposing the judge really took something... most outrageous, maybe make people work in their underwear with a dunce cap or something crazy. That'd still be, that wouldn't trouble you either, I suppose.
It may trouble me as a prosecutor and as an officer of the court. It certainly would, but it does not call into question the jury trial right.
Was the defendant, were either of these defendants sentenced to this particular form of punishment?
Blanton is still not in a convicted status. Fraley is, and I don't recall offhand if his two-day jail sentence was a matter where he's given credit or if he chose community service. He took an appeal, so in fact, the conviction, the judgment following the conviction, has never been enforced.
Well, has the Supreme Court of Nevada ever approved the sentencing of someone to do their 2 days community work in this kind of an outfit?
No, it hasn't addressed the issue.
And the statute says nothing about it.
That's correct. The opportunity, I suppose, existed in the decision below, but it was not addressed as the type of garb that was worn. Regarding the nature of the offense test, the reason, I think, why it's too subjective is best illustrated by language from Clawins, which is reiterated in the Frank opinion, wherein it's stated that doubts must be resolved, not subjectively, by recourse of the judge to his own sympathy and emotions, but by objective standards, such as may be observed in the laws and practices of the community, taken as a gauge of its social and ethical judgments. One other point I wish to make is with regard to the national standards test to which petitioners refer, and that is what I call the head count of states. I don't believe that has constitutional significance, although it appears as though 44 states provide jury trials for persons accused of the first offense DUI. They do so for one of three reasons. First off, their state constitution requires it, or secondly, their state statutory scheme requires it. And thirdly, the other reason why they provide jury trials is because the maximum authorized penalty exceeds 6 months. It exceeds the Baldwin-Bright line anyway. So I don't believe that that is, it's in essence a red herring to argue that 44 states provide it, and therefore Nevada should in this case. Moreover, in Martin versus Ohio, this court held that there was no constitutional dimension to the fact that 48 states had a particular approach to a criminal procedure, in that case the self-defense argument and which side has the burden of proof. In that instance, Ohio and South Carolina were recognized as the only two states that placed the burden of proving self-defense on the defendant. The court there found there was no constitutional dimension to the fact that 48 states did so. Without further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Zalaris. Mr. Graves, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Your Honor, I'll be brief.
You'll have to be.
Yes, sir. This court has ruled in several cases, not per se on the jury trial issue, that the offense of driving under the influence is quite serious. Justices White and Rehnquist, and now Chief Justice Rehnquist, of course, in that decision, Welch versus Wisconsin, and in other cases have found.
Could you speak up a little bit, Mr. Gray?
I'm sorry, sir. I have found this court has painted the offense of driving under the influence in very somber tones. Responding quickly to the clear-cut guideline test, the only thing that I can tell the court is that the lower courts have been applying all three tests for years. Even in the Landry versus Hoffner case in the Fifth Circuit, which does not rule in our direction, applied all three tests. And I think, with respect to them, that it was afraid not to. Because you can't just say, well, it doesn't apply to Baldwin, or it doesn't fit the Baldwin rule, and therefore we're going to deny the right to jury trial.
Do you want us to change Baldwin?
No, sir. No, sir. Not at all. Baldwin has worked well. Counsel spoke about the Frank case and having to overrule Frank. I would think that losing a driver's license is more serious than living the life of a normal citizen in the community. If you lose your license for 45 days, you may lose your job. And if you don't get a restricted license, you're going to lose it for 90 days. And I think that's pretty serious.
Yet you can lose your driver's license by just driving with an expired license. I mean, it wouldn't have to be a criminal proceeding at all.
No, sir, that's true. But in this particular case, and I'm out of time, in this particular case, it is a direct result of the penalty.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.